Okay. So are we really live this time or are we not? Are we just teasing? Yesterday's program was recorded, but unfortunately it was a recorded program that started out announcing we were live, which was a problem, I'm sure, because I'm sure we still were getting calls. We had some technical problems with the internet, and we're not able to connect at the proper time for the radio show yesterday afternoon. And so we had to hastily grab a recorded show to play, because we weren't expecting to have to do that. And the one we chose had a whole bunch of time-sensitive announcements that weren't true. I mean, they were true at the time. It's just that the program was from about 3 years ago in June. And, in fact, June 9th, I think, is the date I mentioned on the show. So it must have really confused you, because I started out. It turned out that it was a show that played a day after we had played a recorded show. So I came on saying, okay, today we're live. Yesterday was recorded. Today we're live. But, in fact, we weren't live. It was we didn't have time to pre-listen that show. I apologize for that. But we are, in fact, live today. And let me just make sure, if it's Wednesday, September 17th, 2014, you may want to look at your iPhone and see if that's the date on there. If it is, then we are live today. And you can call, which I know some of you tried to call yesterday thinking we were live, and it just wasn't so. Well, right now our lines are full, but we do have a number I can give you. And after I've talked to a caller or two and they've moved on, then these lines will be open and you can get through. If you have a question about the Bible or about the Christian faith, that's pretty much what we're here to discuss. This is the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we'll take your calls at this number, 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Daniel from Tacoma, Washington is first in line here. Daniel, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me on. My question regards Jesus' comments in Matthew chapter 7, where he's talking about, well, the narrow path or the narrow gate, and he says the way is hard or difficult. But then there's other scriptures, like in Matthew 11, where he says, you know, come to me, take my yoke upon you, and I will give you rest. So, my yoke is easy. So I was wondering how you understand the certain aspects of following Jesus that are difficult, are hard, but then how you understand the aspects that are easy when you take his yoke upon you.
Sure.
And I'll just take that. I'll take those comments off air. Thank you very much.
Okay, Daniel. Thanks for your call.
You bet.
All right. Well, in what way is the narrow path a hard path? And in what way is Jesus' yoke easy? Well, the narrow path is a hard path, partly because, like Jesus said, there are few that are on it. Jesus said the way to life is difficult, and few there are that find it. And he said it leads to a narrow gate. Now, when you're on a path that few are on, it's somewhat more difficult because you don't have the same kind of encouragement support as if you're going the same way as everybody else. It's a little bit like trying to swim upstream against a current, like the salmon do when they're ready to spawn. And that's kind of what we're doing here. We're going against the grain of culture when we follow Jesus. And not only against the grain of culture, we're going against our own grain in some respects. That is our carnal grain, our flesh. Our flesh would like to take an easy way. Our flesh would like to have as much self-indulgence and comfort as we can afford ourselves. And a lot of people, that's what they're aimed at, because they don't know of anything, you know, of any eternal value that they can aim at. So they just work at having life be as enjoyable and, or at least endurable, as they can make it. But Christianity calls us to die to ourselves, to live for other people, not for ourselves, to say no to some of our desires, some of the strongest desires in some cases, and to take a path which is definitely not the path of least resistance, because the path we're taking often receives criticism and throughout history has received persecution. Now, we haven't received too much persecution in this country, but that could change. And certainly it has been the lot of Christianity throughout history that there has been persecution. The reason for the persecution, of course, is that when you're on a path that few are taking, they don't know why you're not taking their path. Remember, Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 4, that the unbelievers, they think it's strange that you do not run with them to the same excess of evil, and they speak evil of you. Why do they speak evil? Because you're not on the path they're going. In fact, you're going the opposite way. Well, why would that bother them? What do they care? Well, the fact that you're one of the few that's not taking their path, and their path is the way of least resistance, means that you're making an effort to take a path different from theirs. And in a sense, you're taking another path is a statement that they're on the wrong path. If you felt their path was right, you'd be on it too. But the fact that you're taking a different path in life means that you're saying the path they're on is the wrong one. And people don't like to be told they're wrong, especially if they're insecure and they're not sure they're right. So a lot of times, because Christians say, well, I can't do that because I'm following Jesus, when someone invites you to do something, or when someone tells, about something they've done and you can't give your approval because it was unethical or immoral or something like that, it becomes clear that you're on a different path than they are, clear to them, certainly. And either they can humble themselves and say, wow, maybe there's some reason I shouldn't be on this path either. Or more commonly, they say, what, you judging me? You think I'm not okay? You're going a different way? You say I'm not good? And then they persecute you because they don't like to the suggestion that you taking another path is taking. So there's all kinds of difficulties. You go against the grain of culture. You go against your own fleshly cravings in many cases, your own selfish desires, which are very strong in every human being, and you court persecution by following Jesus. So those are reasons why it's a difficult path. Now, why did Jesus say his yoke is easy? Well, it's easy for the same reason that any labor becomes easier when you do it out of love for somebody. There may be jobs that you would find a drudgery, but if you love your wife and you know it would bless her for you to do them, and you do them instead of what you'd prefer to do, it's a joy. Because when you love somebody, it brings you joy to please them. And the Christian life is a life of loving God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength, and loving your neighbor as you love yourself. And therefore, to serve God and to serve your neighbor is made easy because it's a labor of love. And love lightens every load. And so I think that's why his yoke is easy. Now, there's different ways of explaining that. Some people would say his yoke is easy because a yoke is made for two oxen, and you put your head in one side of the yoke, and Jesus is in the other, and his shoulder is up against that yoke, and he's pulling the plow with his strength, and you just get to keep step with him. So it makes your load lighter because he's carrying it with his head is in the other side of the yoke. And Jesus might indeed have had that kind of imagery in mind when he talked about his yoke, but it's not clear that he did, because not every yoke has two animals in it. A yoke might have only one animal in it. A plow is often pulled by one ox, but he still had to be steered by a yoke. And whose yoke is it? It's the ox's master's. The ox is serving his master. He's under his master's yoke, and therefore he's being steered and governed by his master. That's what a yoke is about. So when Jesus said, take my yoke upon you, he might have had in mind a yoke where you put two animals and he's in one and we're in the other, in which case, of course, we could see his strength is that which is making the load light. Or he might not have been thinking of a yoke that has two holes for two animals, but just a yoke that you become his servant. You wear his yoke. You pull his plow. But it's an easy one if you love him. And that's makes all the difference in the world. I knew two Christians who lived very dedicated lives for many years. Both of them very self-sacrificing. Both of them very devout, dedicated to doing the right thing, to following Scripture and so forth. But after many years, one of those left the faith and the other did not. And the one who left said, you know, when I was serving God, it was like I was in a dark cave. And now that I've come out, and I'm no longer a Christian, I feel like I've come out in the light, out of the cave. And the other person said, wow, I never knew they felt that way, because to me, serving God is being in the light, is being out in the light. And to go back into the bar scene and so forth like the partner did, that'd be going into the cave. So it's interesting how the same experience can be a burden to one person and a joy to another. And what makes the difference is love. If you love God, you'll love his people, and you'll love serving him. It says that in 1 John chapter 5. It says, hereby we know that we love God, because we keep his commandments, and they are not burdensome. It's not burdensome to keep the commandments of God if you love him, if if you don't love him, then it's certainly a burden. And so that's the difference between religion, on the one hand, and a walk with God. A walk with God is a walk in love with him, and it's not hard. Yeah, there's hardships, but all lives have hardships. Christianity even has a few more hardships than some other kinds of lives have, but all lives have hardships. The difference is, when you're in love with the person you're serving, those hardships are a light load. And that's what Jesus meant, I think, when he said, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. All right, we've got lines open for you at 1-800-438-5090. Bill from Gold Bar, Washington is our next caller. Bill, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Hey, Bill.
Yeah.
Hey.
Okay, I got a question.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, if you, I just want to pick your brain. If you were to prepare a message for, to help those that sin in ways that they don't care because they're not getting punished right now, and they're looking at the judgment seat of Christ as being, you know, far off. They don't have to worry about it. But encourage them to not sin. So what verses from the Bible did you use in that message to be part of the solution, to help them, to encourage them, you know, some ways that the word was put together, what verses would help them, encourage them to sin less, because it actually is affecting God. It actually is, you know, making him frown. The devil's looking up saying, look what I'm making your children do. You know, what verses would you use in that message to help help them understand that's serious?
Well, there might be any number of verses that would make it clear that serving God is necessary now, and that some people may be living in a false hope that they can get away with sinning because judgment hasn't fallen immediately. One verse that speaks directly to that attitude is Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11 and 12. That's Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11 and 12. It says, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well for those who fear God and who fear before him, but it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. Now that passage is actually Ecclesiastes 8, verse 11 through 13, but especially verse 11. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily. In other words, people do an evil work and they don't suffer for it right away. The sentence is not immediately executed. It says, therefore, the hearts of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. That is, they think they're getting away with something because they do something wrong, and then they cringe and wait for the boom to drop on them, and it doesn't drop. So they say, oh, okay, I guess that worked out okay. So they do it again, and they're kind of looking over their shoulders to see if God's going to whack him, and he doesn't whack him. And so they just keep doing it. Say, I can get away with this, because the judgment, the sentence is not executed speedily. But Psalm says, hey, but I know even if they do it 100 times and they seem to get away with it, they're not getting away with anything. Now Paul in Galatians chapter 6 in verse 7 said, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, he will also reap. For he who sows to the flesh will reap of the flesh corruption. He who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. Now, he's saying here that when you are living your life every day, you are sowing some kind of a crop. You're sowing seeds into a field, and those seeds are going to have consequences. Every act you do has some kind of upshot, has some kind of consequence. And if what you're doing are spiritual things, that is, walking in the Spirit, serving God, serving spiritual goals, well, it's going to produce spiritual results. But if you're doing carnal, selfish, sinful things, well, the results are going to be corruption. And so it's not like you're getting away with something. In fact, Paul begins that statement by saying, don't be deceived. God is not mocked. People are going to reap what they sow. So why would he say don't be deceived? Well, for the very reason that Solomon mentioned. Some people think they're getting away with it. They think they're sowing wild oats, but they're not going to have a harvest of wild oats. And so, but they are. I mean, the sentence against the evil work is not executed speedily, so they just ignore the consequences because they seem far off. And of course, we know very well that no one can count on judgment being far off, since any one of us right now, anyone listening to my voice, including me, could be dead before sundown.
Right.
Some people who are alive right now and healthy will be dead before sundown, somewhere in the world. Somewhere in the world, there are people who are in good health, in the prime of life. They're not in any immediate danger that they know of. And before sundown, they will be dead. And there will be a lot of them, you know. And so, go ahead.
I think you've given me my text, and also you've helped me out before, and I appreciate you for helping me out again. Thank you very much.
Okay, preach it, brother.
Okay, thank you.
God bless you. Bye now. All right, our lines are open if you'd like to be on. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live. And this is not a recorded program. We're on live Wednesday, September 17th. Yesterday's program was not live. Today's program is. If you're looking at your clock or your watch, your calendar, and it's September 17th, 2014. I have to say that because from time to time we play a recorded show, and by accident we might play one that is recorded of a previous program where I mentioned it was live. And then, of course, even though you're listening to the recorded show, it's telling you that it's live, and that's something we're trying to avoid, but it sometimes happens. All right, so our lines are filling up, but think about it. Do you have any questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith? Do you have a disagreement with the host you'd like to register here on the radio show? Feel free to call. The lines are busy right now. All of them are full, but you can take this number down and call as soon as we're done with one of these callers. The number is 1-800-438-5090. Mark from Beaverton, Oregon, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
I was very heavily involved in the Seventh-day Adventist Church for several years.
Mm-hmm.
I no longer am. But some of the beliefs that they have still very much appeal to me.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering if any of their, one of their biggest features is the end time belief.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if any of the things that they teach in there, do you see any agreement or value in?
Well, one thing I agree with them about is that dispensationalism is not true. I mean, they don't believe in dispensationalism, and neither do I. But the directions we go from there differ pretty widely. Their view of the book of Revelation is the historicist view, and I believe that a preterist/idealist view is probably more likely to be true. And so I read Revelation a different way than they do, which does, as I read Revelation, it doesn't give me any information that would help me predict anything about the end times. Now, on the Seventh-day Adventist view is that Revelation tells the whole panorama of church history from John's time till the end, and that we are living very near the end of that time. So they look at the bowls, the vials to pour out and so forth, and they see these as having relevance in modern times. And so they have their Revelation seminars where they invite people to come and have several sessions and learn the whole book of Revelation from their viewpoint. But their viewpoint is not one that I hold about that. I mean, they believe that Jesus, of course, came in the early 1900s for the investigative judgment. And I think, as near as I can tell, the only reason they say that is because they predicted that Jesus would return that year, and he didn't. So it became necessary to say that something happened that could be in some way related to his return. And so they say he came, into the Holy of Holies to do the investigative judgment or something. I feel that the Seventh-day Adventist eschatology, they kind of make it up as they go along because things don't materialize. After all, the Seventh-day Adventist movement arose after the Millerite movement fell. There were remnants of the Millerites that kind of grew out of those roots. And the Millerites had predicted the second coming of Christ in the middle 1800s on a specific date, and it didn't happen. And that was called the Great Disappointment. And the Millerite movement pretty much mostly fall apart, but the Seventh-day Adventists grew out of it. But they've also had their mistaken predictions. I think any group that's predicting a specific date for the end of the world is not being very responsible. And I would even say anyone who says that we're near the end of the world and says so with any kind of, and says that they have biblical authority for saying so, is going beyond what they can really do from the Bible. See, I would have no trouble saying, in my gut, I feel like we could be near the end of the world. But I couldn't tell you that on a biblical basis, based on Scripture, that we're near the end of the world, because the Scripture doesn't say one thing about the year 2014 or how near the end of the world 2014 is. So anyone who says that it is near the end is, of course, going by gut instincts or considerations that are not really biblical.
Right. One thing that does stick with me, and I agree with everything you just said, and that's part of the reason why I'm no longer involved, but there's other reasons too. But one thing that does stick with me that I don't really know the explanation for is they do have a good explanation for the Antichrist saying he will think to change the times and the laws.
Right, and they identify the papacy with the Antichrist and the popes changing times. Right, yeah.
What do you make of that verse? How do you interpret that?
Well, I mean, in Daniel, where it says that the little horn will seek to change times and laws, it doesn't say which times or which laws. It doesn't say the laws of God. You know, it doesn't say what he's actually changing. He could be changing the whole governmental system from a previous form, and it wouldn't have anything to do with the laws of God. We just aren't told, you know. I mean, somebody who tries to change the laws of God, we could say, well, that person changes the laws. Well, that would be correct, but is that the same changing of the laws that's referred to? That would be something we'd have to establish on other bases. To my mind, changing Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday was a mistake on the part of the Pope. But the Christians were worshiping on Sunday a long time before anyone said it was the Sabbath. I mean, in the book of Acts, the Sabbath is still recognized as Saturday. Every time the term Sabbath is used in the book of Acts, it's referring to the Jewish Sabbath, Saturday, like when Paul went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day or something like that. But Christians met every day, actually, and very early, long before there were any popes, Christians were worshiping primarily on Sunday. They weren't calling it the Sabbath. They were just worshiping on Sunday. They called it the Lord's Day. They knew Saturday was the Sabbath, but they didn't believe that the Sabbath was a law for Christians. They believed the Sabbath was a law for the Old Covenant, and the New Covenant had replaced the Old Covenant. So they believed that Sunday, as the day that Jesus rose from the dead, was a day they preferred to meet on, but they didn't change it to the Sabbath. It was centuries later that one of the popes decided that Sunday would now be called the Sabbath, and that was a huge mistake, in my opinion. I don't think Sunday's the Sabbath. I think Saturday's the Sabbath, but the question is the Sabbath something that Christians are supposed to be observing or not? And that's where Seventh-day Adventists would differ from many of us.
Yeah, that's the primary reason I've walked from it. But I'm also the thing that drew me to it in the first place really, ironically, had nothing to do with Saturday worship. It was their annihilationist view drew me to it because I couldn't, you know, in my mind get, you know, reconcile the burning in hell for everything. That really was bothering me, and I was like,
sure. Well, you probably didn't know then, but there are other groups that teach annihilation also, besides the Seventh-day Adventists, though they're probably the most well-known for it. Of course, Jehovah's Witnesses also teach it, but there are evangelical groups, at least evangelical preachers, who personally believe and teach annihilation.
Yeah, but you're right. At the time when I was searching that, the Adventists were the ones that stuck out the most mm-hmm. prevalent.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the best known for it.
Yeah, and yeah, that's what drew me to it. But some of the other stuff, I was like, not so sure about this.
mm-hmm. But, well, I actually think they put Ellen G. White in a position that is not in my mind healthy. I mean, all Christians have authors that they respect, and teachers that they respect, and books they like to read, and pastors they like to listen to, and so forth. But I believe that Ellen G. White in the Seventh-day Adventist Church holds a position considerably higher than most Christians place their pastor or their favorite author in. And while she didn't claim to be a prophet, from what I understand, certainly it is believed by most Seventh-day Adventists that I've known that she is one, or was one. And yeah. I believe an awful lot of what she taught was speculation, and it was not prophecy.
Yep, she was referred to a prophetess many times in the studies I went to.
Yeah, it's common for Seventh-day Adventists to call her that. And frankly, I believe she was a smart lady, and I think she was a godly lady. I really do. I, as near as I can tell, she wrote some wonderful things. Although it is, as I understand it, I think she plagiarized a lot of what she wrote, too. But I think that she, nonetheless, had much good to say. But it's the things she said that don't seem scriptural to me that I would say, you know, that's where I would part company with her. And see, that's what I would do with any teacher. One of my favorite writers is C.S. Lewis, and I think he's great, but there's a number of points he makes that I wouldn't agree with him on. He's an Anglican. I'm not an Anglican. You know, he had a lot of views, not a lot, but not important ones, but lesser views that I would disagree with him about. And yet, if I were a Seventh-day Adventist, I don't know if I'd feel the liberty to disagree with Mrs. White about things that I thought weren't biblical. I guess they do feel the liberty to, but I'm not sure if they ever challenge her.
Not from what I saw, no.
Yeah.
And one more thing, just real quick. Speaking of churches that put, you know, other things too high up in the hierarchy, have you heard this news about the Pope's saying that Mary is a new place in the, they're calling it a quadrilogy now instead of a trinity or something?
Is that right? Which, yeah. the present Pope said that?
Yeah, it was just in the Yahoo News today.
No, I hadn't heard that. Well, it's a small step from where they already were.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always felt that the Roman Catholics had a very unhealthy view of Mary, and that it bordered on idolatry. Of course, Protestants almost always think that about Catholics, and I'm no different. I do think that about them. But at the same time, I think some lovely people who love the Lord are in the Catholic Church, but I think it's a very serious error to place Mary that high. And if they actually are making her like another member of the Trinity, now I haven't heard that news. It seems like I'm surprised I haven't heard it if that was announced today. But yeah, that's definitely a step down, way down from orthodoxy.
Yeah, maybe check it out tonight if you have time, and maybe we'll talk about it some more later this week.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
It's good to hear from you.
God bless.
God bless you, too. Ralph from Salinas is next. Ralph, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How are you doing today?
Good.
Good. My question today is, like, David and Solomon had many wives.
Yeah.
In the Old Testament, then, when Moses, when God gave the laws to Moses, didn't he say that only one wife in the laws, in the Torah?
No. No, there's no place in the Bible that says that a person must have only one wife, but there was a command that the kings of Israel should not multiply wives. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, it says that the king shall not multiply wives. That's Deuteronomy 17:17. And so one could argue, one might argue that means he should have only one wife. There weren't many kings in Israel, or probably in any country in the world, that had only one wife, because for the king to have a harem was a very common thing. But when God said he should not multiply wives, one might suggest, well, at what point are you multiplying them? You know, if you add a few, is that multiplying? Well, Solomon certainly multiplied. No matter how you define multiplication, Solomon was guilty of multiplying wives. David had 8 wives, as far as we know. Whether that gets into the area of multiplication or just addition, I don't really know. But the point is, the king was not supposed to have a bunch of wives. And likewise, leaders in the church are not supposed to. They're supposed to be husbands of one wife, as Paul said twice. But there were apparently people, there certainly were people in Israel, and there might have even been people in the early church who had more than one wife because they'd had more than one wife before they got converted. That happens today in some tribal groups where a tribal leader or something gets converted and he's got 3 wives or 10 wives or something like that. And now he's a Christian and he's got multiple wives. because he had multiple wives before. Now, some people think that's adultery, but the Bible never calls that adultery. Adultery is when you're sleeping with somebody else's wife. That's what adultery is in the Bible. But for a man to have multiple wives was actually never forbidden. But it was never portrayed as a desirable thing. It was never portrayed as a thing that leads to happiness in the home. In fact, every marriage we know of in the Old Testament where there was more than one wife had conflicts. Jacob had four wives, two wives and two concubines, and his two wives fought it out. They were in competition all the time. Elkanah, the father of Samuel, had two wives, and there was competition between them. Even Abraham had Sarah and then Hagar, and there was a conflict between them as well. It just seems like every time you find polygamy being practiced, you find unhappiness in the home. Now, I think the New Testament tells us much more about what marriage is supposed to be than the Old Testament did. In the Old Testament, they didn't know much about what marriage is supposed to be, except that you're supposed to be faithful to your wife or wives. You're not supposed to cheat. You're not supposed to go sleep with your neighbor's wife. But the main thing I think ancient people looked at marriage for was for starting and growing a family. And I believe what happened a lot of the time, we see it in the case of Abraham and Jacob, and also in the case of Elkanah I mentioned, it would appear that a man might have a wife and might only be interested in having one wife, but his wife can't have kids. And therefore, because he needs to have a family, he takes another wife. And you know, who knows, maybe even more he takes. But the idea is that a wife is to help you build a family. A wife is to have children. And that's how the Middle Eastern people and ancient people in general looked at marriage. You get married to have kids. And if your wife can't give you children, then you got to get another one too. And if you have three wives or four, you can have a lot of kids, you know, a lot faster. And so this was the mentality, I think. Both, not just of Old Testament people, but of all people in those regions and in those cultures. And God didn't necessarily forbid it. But in the New Testament, we find that marriage has a greater purpose than simply to crank out babies. And that is to be a picture of Christ in the church. And that was not revealed in the Old Testament. And God didn't hold them to that standard in the Old Testament. Remember, Jesus said in Matthew 19, that God allowed people in the Old Testament to divorce their wives because of the hardness of their hearts, but that's something that Jesus was not in favor of. And Paul said that marriage is a picture of Christ and the church, which certainly was not something that the Jews in the Old Testament understood. So if we recognize now this much more about marriage, about its nature, about God's intentions for it, we realize that polygamy really doesn't fit in at all, because Christ only has one bride and not two. And not more. So the fact that the church is one bride of Christ, and Christ has only one bride, means that a man who wishes for his marriage to please God and to resemble the image of Christ in the church would have only one wife.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Ralph. Thanks for your call. All right. Let's talk to John from Las Vegas, Nevada. John, welcome to The Narrow Path, and thanks for waiting.
Yes, Steve. I'm 62 now. And
I'm almost there. I'll be 62 at my next birthday.
I know. I'm a very little bit. I haven't taught you for a while. Anyway, my life has changed, and I got freedom. I took the 80% and minor income. I heard you talking about these guys that go homeless to evangelize a little while ago. That,
yeah.
By the way, I'm glad I got the resurrected show. And my question was just, like, since you know men that have done this, because I'm really getting pulled to this, not here in Las Vegas. I've been here 56 years. That's enough. But I'm kind of being pulled up to Eureka in Crescent City. So can you tell me something about what you know of going that way?
Well, one thing I know is that if I was going to be homeless, I'd rather be homeless in Las Vegas than in Eureka or Crescent City. Just because,
really?
Well, I'm not saying you should be homeless. I don't encourage it necessarily, but Eureka and Crescent City have some cold weather and some wet weather, whereas I would think that it'd be a lot easier to survive, you know, on the street in Las Vegas. But what do I know? I've never tried it. I used to live in my car when I was a teenager, when I was a teenager and first in Israel, I lived in my car, but that's the closest I came to living on the street, and that was still a pretty protected environment. I have a friend in San Diego who's voluntarily homeless, and he's homeless so that he can minister to the homeless people, and we also got a call the other day from someone somewhere else. I don't know much about what that involves. I really don't. But
I can happen if you wind up homeless.
Well, if you wind up homeless, you know, it turn it into a ministry, I guess, you know.
That's what I'm thinking. I cannot fade like you do the minutiae of doctrine. You know, to me, it's completely irrelevant, not necessary. And people have these questions. You know, there's the Lord Jesus Christ and then everything else. In my mind, I'm down to that basic. I think I'm being fed the Spirit within. I mean, you call it, mental thought transference, however you want to say it. You know, he's feeding me, and I'm getting tugged, so I just wonder what you thought.
Well, maybe I'm becoming aware just now of a growing trend toward people being homeless to have homeless ministries. One of the things I would say about being homeless is that, I mean, I would not object to being homeless, especially if I were single, didn't have a family to be concerned about. I don't mind living homeless, but I wouldn't really want to be a burden on society. And I don't like the idea of begging. If you're getting, you got Social Security or something, right?
Yeah, and even that's, I've heard, devout Christians speak, especially one guy, I can't remember his name, he's highly, way up there, highbrow intellect, and he says nobody should take help from the state. It's against the, I can't go there. I work for it.
Well, that's it. I once thought, I don't want to take Social Security. First of all, I don't think I'll need it because I trust God. And secondly, I don't want my kids to have to bear the burden. But on the other hand, if I don't take Social Security, and I'm not taking it yet, I'm not old enough yet, but if I don't take it, that doesn't mean my kids are not going to have the load. They're going to still be paying into it. I'm not going to be doing my kids any favor by not taking it. You did pay into it. I actually wish, as far as my life is concerned, I would be just much happier if there never had been Social Security. Now, there's a lot of people who depend on it, and I'm sure their life is happier because it's there. But just for my own self, I don't have any interest in collecting Social Security, and I just assume I didn't have to pay it every year. You know, I mean, I don't need the government to make me secure. I have God to make me secure. But since I have had to pay into it, I guess I don't mind getting back what I put into it.
Well, his ways are mysterious. You know, 46 years in hotels and casinos. That's all I can tell you is I really would like to leave Las Vegas. It's getting pretty nasty here.
Well, I don't blame you. Yeah, there's no water there either.
No. And the people who are coming here to evangelize now are younger men who are here for a reason. They're getting drawn here by the droves.
Huh.
So, but when the promise keepers come here, the porn goes up 80%. You know, I have to say that too.
That is weird. That's very weird.
Yeah. It's a true statistic as far as we know, unless somebody's trying to knock them.
Well, I'm sure there are people trying to knock them, but I don't know if the statistic might be true anyway. I have no idea. Anyway, John, I'm sorry that your circumstances have been reduced to this level, but, you know.
No, I don't have to do that, but I just feel like I want to get out there, you know, and do basic. This is really basic.
Yeah.
People need it.
Do you have a car or an RV or a van or anything?
Yeah, I don't have a VW bus. Try and find one. I wish I did.
I know.
But, I'm okay.
Well, brother, I don't know what to say, but God bless you. I'm glad you're able to get your Social Security so you won't have to be, you know, standing on an off-ramp with your hand out.
Well, see, that freed me up out of here, and I really think that, you know how it goes. First your money, then your clothes.
Yeah. Well, brother.
Thanks for talking to me, Steve.
I know there's a lot of brothers in your shape, and I'm glad you're taking lemon and making lemonade, you know, turn it into ministry.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm old enough, and no wife, no kids, no pets, no plants, you know, I'm freed up.
Yeah. King of the road.
Yeah.
No home, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes.
I'll call you from a payphone if I can find one.
Okay.
Later.
God bless you, John. Bye now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Victor from Seattle, Washington, you're up next. Welcome.
Yes, hi, Steve.
Hi.
So it's a shifting, sorry to hear that from him.
Yes. Yes.
But I really appreciate when you talk about legalism and pharisaical attitude. I think it's quite helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask something else about, you know, how oftentimes, maybe it's just me, but I think a lot of us Christians, we grew up with, in the morning, read the Bible, pray in the morning before you go to bed, or whatever sort of human tradition may have been created and place God first. The question is, when do you think those sort of traditions, and I know you talked about the Sabbath day, whether it's Saturday or Sunday, and some people get legalistic about that, you can't, I don't know if the Amish say you can't, you're not allowed to use electricity. I don't know, but I know every denomination, every different sect has a different way of doing things. When do you think it could get dangerous where we make human tradition into a legalistic attitude where it creates a lot of guilt? Because I know you kind of mentioned into the mind of a Pharisee, I thought that was fascinating of how they think that they're just living under guilt, because I sometimes feel guilty for not doing something. And I kind of catch myself, am I getting a little bit overly legalistic over that, or is it because I really want to spend time with God? And obviously I want to spend time with God and learn about him and act on it. But do you know, I don't know if you can think of maybe a list of, or something that you may have heard. I know with the Catholic religion, they have rosaries that they have to hold on to, I think every day or something, and they got to do that. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but that sort of fixation where eventually it becomes like an affectation, something you just got to do for the sake of doing it. Is it anything that you think that we do that you think could be dangerous, or is there a point at which we have to be careful?
Well, the danger is that you would be like a Pharisee, and the Pharisee's problem was that they had a wrong view of God. They saw God as somebody whose love was conditioned on their performance. And this view, of course, made them nervously efficient about keeping every little dot and tittle of the law. But also, it made them very judgmental toward others, because they figured God is. They figure God's angry at people who aren't performing as well. And therefore, when they see other people who aren't doing all the things they're doing, they assume God's angry at them, and they themselves, they're angry at them for two reasons. One is because they figure God is, and secondly, because that person's got it easier than they've got it, because their conscience won't let them stop doing all this legalism. And someone else who's not living under all those rules, you know, that person's enjoying life a lot more than they are. They feel jealous, but they don't, you know, they may not even define it as jealousy. They just see it as resentment and anger and judgmentalism. So a Pharisee is very judgmental and condemning of people, and they think God is. And there's a lot of Christians who think God is that way, by the way. And therefore, they dare not eat their food without saying a prayer, because God might be angry. They dare not withhold their tithe because they're afraid they may go broke. God may judge them for that. They dare not miss church on Sunday or any number of things that they think they must do to please God. Now, that's just the wrong view of God. The right view of God is that God is our Father, that he loves us, and he wants us to love him because we should. He's lovable. You know, if you don't love somebody who's really a good and lovable person, there's something wrong with you. I mean, lovableness should evoke a response of love, just like faithfulness in a person should evoke the response of trust toward them. And what God's looking for is people who know their God, who know who he is. This is eternal life, Jesus said, that they might know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom you have sent. So knowing God as he is what Christianity amounts to. And when you do know God as he is, you realize he doesn't want you to be nervously trying to dot every I and cross every T to out of fear that he's going to be angry if you don't. He's, you know, he has things he wants you to do, of course, just like every father has things he wants his children to do. The trouble is if when my children were little and I gave them chores to do, to wash the dishes or mow the lawn or something like that, well, they should do those things. Not legalistically, though. They shouldn't do it out of fear that if they didn't do it, I'm going to disinherit them. I'm going to kick them out of the house. They will not be my children anymore. They should do it because they recognize me as their dad, and they love me, and they're part of my family, and they accept the responsibilities that comes with that. And, you know, lots of people have done their household chores with joy because it's part of helping the family out and pleasing their parents and things like that. But when someone's totally selfish and all they care about is, you know, not getting into trouble, and they're just afraid that their parents are going to, you know, beat them or something or reject them, then, of course, doing the chores is really a drudgery. Legalism is a false view of God. It's the view that God loves you if you keep his laws. Christianity is the opposite. It's that God loves you, and therefore you should love him. And if you love him, you'll keep his commandments. So you end up keeping his laws anyway. A Christian is going to be somebody who's obedient, but they're obedient because they love God. Like Jesus said, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. So that's the opposite of, if you keep my commandments, I will love you. Now, it is true that God does love those who keep his commandments, but he loves those who love him and keep his commandments. Those who keep commandments in a wooden, externalistic, grudging way and don't love him, he doesn't love that particular attitude. So what it comes down to is what kind of relationship you have with God. And Christianity is a relationship of love between a loving father and loving children. And of course, children obey. That's what children do. But they do it out of love if they're Christians, not out of terror and fear and drudgery.
Right, okay. So you think the Pharisees in the olden days had that sense, that fear and terror inside their heart?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Jesus said, I know you that you have no love of God in you. Well, if they don't love God, what are they doing? Well, they're either trying to make a name for themselves by pretending to be holy, or they're trying to be holy because they're afraid of God, but they're not doing it because they love God, and therefore they weren't really part of his movement at all. Now, you mentioned things like getting up and having Bible study in the morning and things like that, and if you have a habit of that, is that legalism? I don't see why that would necessarily be legalism. Even if you go to bed one night and say, you know, I really don't feel like getting up, but I'm going to anyway. Now, even that isn't necessarily legalistic. It might just be trying to maintain a good discipline. If my wife has certain things she wants me to do on weekends, and, you know, there's something I might rather do on the weekend, but I do it anyway. It's not because I'm under some kind of law that she's requiring me to do it, but because I want my wife to be pleased. I mean, she does a lot of things for me. I want to do as many things for her as I can. And that's how it should be with us and God. God's done so much for us. We should want to please him as much as we can. I mean, we should reciprocate. And so it's just all in the attitude. It's in the attitude, am I doing this because I'm afraid I'm going to be punished if I don't do it, if I'm going to be rejected, that God is a God who loves people entirely on a performance orientation basis? Well, then that person doesn't know God, and they're just doing a religious thing that probably is going to be a drudgery and a burden to them, and they'll probably become a very embittered, legalistic person, or just get out of religion altogether eventually.
Yeah. So in other words, getting up in the morning. Yeah, that I didn't think about it. It's. I think I heard Greg Laurie talk about it too. The discipline is important. Have the discipline to do that, and if we don't do it, it's not like God doesn't like us anymore. Because sometimes I might go to bed, I'm just tired, and I say, God, I am just pooped. I'm going to sleep.
Well, you know, suppose you have a job and you're working for an employer, and it's a good job, and you're living at a time when most people are unemployed, and so you're thankful to have a job, and your boss, you know, wants you to come in at a certain time of the day. Well, you might rather sleep in, but you'll get up and go. Not because you think if you missed it once that you'll be fired, but just because you're thankful to have a job. You don't resent your boss's authority. You're glad to be part of his team. You know, you want the company to succeed, and you're going to do your part, and it's not legalistic at all. Now, if you hated your work and hated your boss, but, you know, you just, the only reason you went into work is because you're pretty sure you'd get fired if you didn't, and you're scared to death, well, then that'd be a very unpleasant working situation. But if you actually love your your job and you know, appreciate your boss and so forth, you might even stay overtime and not put it on your not clock. You know, you might clock out and still put in overtime for free, because it's good for the company. You know, it's, in other words, you're not just doing it. You're not just doing the least you can to still avoid disaster. You know,
exactly. Yeah, my question basically is, I think it was probably also an examination of our own heart. I think you may have touched upon it, because what I picture is offering. When we give an offering on Sunday, do we just whip out our wad, here's a buck, here's $100, or whatever? Or as opposed to, I know in the biblical times, they had to literally prepare, and it shows a heart's attitude of respect to prepare, kill the bull, or whatever they had to do. They had to spend time and their own resources to do that. But these days when we give an offering, it's just, is it a legalistic thing that we do, or is it something we do it out of the gratitude of our hearts as a cheerful giver?
Well, I can't answer that until I know someone's heart, but I can say that that's the difference. Is it a legalistic thing, or is it done happily out of love? If it's done out of love, it's not legalistic. If it's done out of legalism, it's legalistic. I appreciate your call. And by the way, I got a message from my on my screen here that John, our homeless friend who called a moment ago, I have a friend named Tom in Santa Cruz who works with homeless people there, and he'd love to be in touch with you. So if you want to somehow contact me, I would say either call my call screener and leave some way that you can be contacted, or else email me from a library or something like that. I could try to put you in touch with Tom if you're interested. That's in Santa Cruz, California. Tom works with homeless people. Let's talk to Dennis, but we don't have much time. Dennis, I'm sorry to say, this is not fair to you, but welcome.
Yes, I can take my call. So I understand that children are a blessing, and we are to multiply and to fill the earth. And, some religions even take it too far, and I think they should be the ones to fill the earth with just their family. The question is it a command to have children? Because I understand we as parents are responsible for them, right? We are to raise them up in the faith. Right. But what if it's beyond our, you know, our control, and they go away from the faith, and they
Well, that happens. That happens. When God gives you children, they are a stewardship, and you need to do your very best to raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. If you do the best you can and they go astray, well, that's not your fault, and they are in the hands of God. The upbringing you gave them may very well come back to haunt them and bring them back to Christ later in life, although it's much nicer if they don't ever drift away at all. The main thing is that if you've done what you can to raise your children for God and they go astray, you don't have to feel that, you know, God holds that against you. There are things you can do and things you can't. And one thing you can't do is totally control the free will of an adult child. Now, as far as, is it a command to have children? No, some people are the Bible acknowledges some people remain single so that they don't have the encumbrance of family and children. But if people get married, certainly one of the main reasons that marriage exists is for having children. Now, I can't tell anyone how many children they should have, but the Bible does say it's a blessing to have your quiver full. So I would think if we believe what the Bible says, we'd probably welcome as many children as God would give us. Now, some people are trusting God to give them children, and he just doesn't give them any. Some people are not able to have children, and some have a lot. But I see God's providence in that, and that's his business. And I wanted 12 children. I only got 5. So what are you going to do? You know, we didn't do anything to prevent it. God's in charge of those things ultimately. But I do think that we should be trusting God about those matters. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I can't trust him to extend the next 25 seconds any longer than it's going to be already, so I have to sign off. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air, go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and find out how to donate. There's also free stuff there at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us, and let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.